It seemed stolid insanity that Herohark's only reaction was to slide up the plexiform barrier and hold down the communication button to ask, "How long must we wait?" The navigator's voice crackled back. "We are securing your clearance to land, Your Grace." Hero didn't thank him. "How long?" "They are scanning your craft now, Your Grace, and will move the moment they have confirmed you're free to leave orbit." The Reverend Daughter sank back into her chair, stuffing her prayer bones into a fold of her robe. Quite unwillingly, Gideon caught her eye. The expression on the other girl's face wasn't disinterest or distraction, as she'd assumed. Even through a layer of veiling, she could tell that Hera was near incapacitated with concentration. Her mouth was pinched in a tight ripple, worrying the black-painted blotch on the lower lip into blood. It took less than 5 minutes for the thrusters to creak to life again, for the ship to slowly glide out of orbit. Next to them, in a line, 7 other shuttles were drifting to one side, sliding into the atmosphere like dominoes falling. Hera shook her head back into her hood and pinched the bridge of her nose, and said in tones between pleasure and pain, "This planet's unbelievable." "It's gorgeous. It's a grave," said Herohark. The shuttle broke orbit, haloed by coruscating light. This burn-off meant there was nothing to see but sky. But the sky of the first house was the same improbable, ludicrous blue as the water. Being on the outside of the planet was like living in a kaleidoscope. It was a lurching blur for long moments, a whine as air pockets in the thick atmosphere made the engines scream, a jolt as the craft repressurized to match, and then the shuttle was a slingshot bullet, an accelerating shell. The brightness was too much to bear. Gideon got the impression of 100 spires rising, choked with green stuff from blue and turquoise waters, before she had to squeeze her eyes shut and turn away wholesale. She pressed the fabric of the embroidered 9th robes to her face and had to breathe through her nose. "Idiot!" Herohark's voice was distant and full of badly suppressed adrenaline. "Here, take this veil!" Gideon kept mopping at her eyes. "I'm all good. I said put it on. I'm not having you struck blind when the door opens."
"I came prepared, my sweet."
"What are you even saying half the time?" The glow changed, strobing, and now the shuttle was slowing down. The light cleared, brightened, dazzled. Herohark threw herself upon the shutter and slammed it down. She and Gideon stood in the center of the passenger bay, staring at each other. Gideon realized that Hera was trembling. Little licks of whole black hair were pasted to her pale grey forehead with sweat, threatening to dissolve the paint. Gideon realized with a start that she was trembling and sweating in concert. They looked at each other with a wild surmise, and then started dabbing at their faces with the insides of their sleeves. "Hood up," breathed Herohark. "Hide that ridiculous hair."
"Your dead mummified mother's got ridiculous hair."
"Griddle, we're within the planet's halo now, and I will delight in violence." A final thuddering clunk. Complete stillness. The seals on the outside were unlatched by some outside force, and as light blazed around the edges of the hatch, Gideon winked at her increasingly agitated companion. She said, sotto voce, "But then you couldn't have admired these," and whipped on the glasses she'd unearthed back home. They were ancient, smoked glass sunglasses with thin black frames and big mirrored lenses, and they greyed out Hera's expression of incredulous horror as she adjusted them on her nose. That was the last thing she saw before the light got in. And then the outside of the first house was open to them, a rush of warm air ruffling their robes and drying the sweat on their faces. Before the hatch had even shuddered to a halt, Hero, aggravated, had disappeared completely. Lady Harrowhark Nona Jessimus, the reverend daughter of the House of the Ninth, swept onto the docking ramp instead. Counting 5 full breaths to mark time, Gideon Nav, Cavalier of the Ninth House, came following behind, praying that her unfamiliar sword wouldn't tangle in her robes. They were on the enormous metal-plated dock of what must have surely been the most impressive structure the First House had ever built. It might have been the most impressive structure anyone had ever built. Gideon didn't have a lot to go on. Rearing up before them was a palace, a fortress of white and shining stone. It spread out on the surface of the water like an island. You couldn't see over it, and you could hardly see around it. It lapped back in terraces of what must have once been fabulous gardens. It rose up in gracious towers that hurt the eye with their slenderness and precision. It was a monument to wealth and beauty. Back in its day, at least, it would have been a monument to wealth and beauty. In the present, it was a castle that had been killed. Many of its white and shining towers had crumbled and fallen down in miserable chunks. Jungling overgrowth rose from the sea and wrapped around the base of the building, both green slimes and thick vines. The gardens were grey, filmy canopies of dead trees and plants. They had overtaken the windows, the balconies, the balustrades, and clung there and died. They covered much of the frontage in a secretive mist of expired matter. Gold veins shone dully in the dirty white walls. The docking bay must have also been elegant in its era, a huge landing swathe that could have held 100 ships at a time. Now 92 of the cradles were desolate and filthy. The metal was caked with salt from the water, salt that now assaulted Gideon's nose, a thick, briny scent, overpowering and wild. The whole place had the look of a picked-up body. But hot damn, what a beautiful corpse! The dock was alive with movement. 5 other ships had landed and were expelling their contents. But there was no time for that. Someone had come to meet them. Harrowhark did not care for any herald. She had drifted out like a black ship in sail, a bony figure wreathed in layers and layers of night-coloured cloth with a lace overcloak trailing behind her, adorned with bones, painted like a dead woman, eyes blindfolded with black net. Now she dropped to her knees 5 paces from the shuttle door and began counting prayers on the knuckle beads in a click-clack monotone. Showtime. Gideon ambled over and knelt next to Hero on the sun-warmed metal of the dock, her own robes pooling black around her, staring inscrutably at the tint-dimmed chaos of what was going on. The clacking beads made her almost feel normal.
"Hail to the Lady of the Ninth House!" warbled a voice delightedly, bringing the count of people who had ever been happy to see Hero up to 3. "Hail to her cavalier! Oh, hail, hail, hail to the child of the far-off and shadowed jewel of our empire! What a very happy day!"
A little old man stood in front of them. He was small and reedy, in the way that reminded Gideon of the oldest of the House of the Ninth, but he had the straightest back and rudest good health of any old man Gideon had ever seen. He was like an old and twisted oak still covered with leaves. He was bald, with a neat, clipped white beard and a golden circlet at his brow. His white robe had no hood and was long enough to brush his calves, and he wore a half-cloak of brushed white wool. Around his waist was a gorgeous belt. It was made of some shimmering gold stuff, and it was embroidered with a multitude of jewel colours in intricate patterns and shapes. They looked like flowers, or flourishes, or both. They looked as though they had been made 1,000 years ago, and kept in loving perfection. Everything about him was ageless and pristine. Harrowhark pocketed her prayer beads.
"Hail to the House of the First," she intoned. "Hail to the King Undying."
"Hail to the Lord over the river," quavered the little priest. "And welcome to this house, blessed lady of the ninth, the reverend daughter. The ninth has not visited the first house for most of this myriad, but your cavalier is not Ortus Snigenad."
The slightest pause. "Ortus Snigenad has abdicated his post," said Harrow, from the depths of her hood. "Gideon Nav has taken his place as Cavalier Primary. I am the Lady Harrowhark Nona Jessimus."
"Then welcome to the Lady Nona Jessimus and to Gideon the Ninth. Once you have finished your prayers," said the little priest effervescently, "you must stand and be honoured and come into the sanctum. I am a keeper of the first house and a servant to the Necrolord Highest, and you must call me teacher, not due to my own merits of learning, but because I stand in the stead of the merciful God above death, and I live in hope that one day you will call him teacher, and you may call him master, too, and may I call you then Harrowhark the First. Be at rest, Lady Nona Jessimus, be at rest, Gideon the Ninth."
Gideon the Ninth, who would have paid cash to be called absolutely anything else, rose as her mistress rose. They exchanged glances that even through one layer of veiling and one layer of tinted glass were violently hostile, but there was too much going on to stand and pull go-to-hell faces at each other. Gideon saw other white-robed figures darting to and fro between the shuttles, coming out of open double doors, but it took a moment to realize that these were skeletons in plain white, with white knots at their waists. They were using long metal poles to work the mechanisms that held the shuttles safely coupled to their latches, with that strange lockstep oneness in which the dead always worked. And then there were the living, waiting in twos, awkwardly shuffling their feet next to their ships. She had never seen so many different people, so many people not of the ninth, and it almost dizzied her, but not enough so that she couldn't pick out when something was amiss. "I only count six shuttles," said Gideon. Harrowhark shot her a look for speaking out of turn, but the little priest teacher cackled as though he were pleased.
"Oh, well noticed. Very good. Yes, there's a discrepancy," he said, "and we don't much like discrepancies. This is holy land. We might be called over-careful, but we hold this house as sacred to the Emperor, our Lord. We do not get many visitors, as you might think. There is nothing that much the matter," he added, and with a confiding air. "It's the House of the Third and the House of the Seventh. No matter, no matter. I'm sure they will be given clearance any moment now. We needed clarification, an inconsistency in both."
"Inconsistency," repeated Harrowhark, as though she were rolling the word around her mouth like a sweet.
"Yes, the House of the Third will, of course, push the boundaries. Of course they would. And the House of the Seventh, well, it's well known. Look, they're landing now."
Most of the other heirs and cavaliers had left their shuttles, and the skeletons were busy pulling luggage out from their holds. The last two shuttles slowly spiraled down to earth, a fresh gust of warm wind scything over everyone as they came to their fluttering rest. Skeletons with poles were already there to greet them, and other living priests, one for each arriving shuttle. They were alive and well, dressed in identical vestments to teachers. This made just three priests total, which made Gideon wonder why the ninth always scored so much geriatric attention. The two new shuttles had both alighted next to the ninth's, the seventh's closest and the third's one over,
which was close enough to see who or what was inside as the third's hatch opened. Gideon was hugely interested to see three figures emerge. The first was a rather sulky young man with an air of hair gel and filigree, an ornate rapier at the belt of his buttoned coat. The cavalier. The other two were young women, both blonde, though the similarity ended there. One girl was tall and statuesque, with a star-white grin and masses of bright gold curls. The other girl seemed smaller, insubstantial, with a sheet of hair the anemic colour of canned butter and an equally bloodless smirk. They were actually the same height, Gideon realised. Her brain had just deemed that proposition too stupid to credit on first pass. It was as though the second girl were the starved shadow of the first, or the first an illuminated reflection. The boy just looked a bit of a dick. Gideon rubbernecked until a white-robed priest with another party-coloured belt hurried over from the trio to them, tapping on teacher's shoulder and murmuring in worried half-heard snatches. "We're inflexible. The household's backing. Born at the exact... both the adept." Teacher waved it off with an indulgent hand and a wheezing laugh. "What can we do? What can we do? But it's impossible."
"Only trouble at the end of the line," he said, "and a trouble confined to them."
Once the other priest had gone, Herohark said repressively, "Twins are an ill omen." Teacher seemed tickled.
"How delightful to hear someone say an ill omen could come from the mouth of the Emperor!"
From the shuttle that carried the seventh house came consternation. The skeletons had pried the hatch open, and someone totted out. In what felt like painful slow motion, like time had decided to slow to a gruesome crawl to show itself off, they had fainted dead away into the arms of the waiting priest, an old man who was singularly unprepared for it. His legs and arms were buckling. The figure was dragging on the ground, threatening to spill entirely. There was red blood on the priest's front. He cried out. Gideon never ran unless she had to, and Gideon ran now. Her legs moved as swiftly as her awful judgment, and all of a sudden she was scooping the crumpled, drooping figure out of the priest's buckling arms, lowering his cargo to the ground as he murmured in amazement. In response, the ice-cold point of a blade bit gently through her hood to the back of her neck, right up to the base of her skull.
"Yo," said Gideon, her head absolutely still. "Step off."
The sword did not step off.
"This isn't a warning," she said. "I'm just saying, give her some air."
For the person folded up in Gideon's arms seemed a her. It was a slender young thing, whose mouth was a brilliant red with blood. Her dress was a frivolous concoction of seafoam green frills, the blood on it startling against such a backdrop. Her skin seemed transparent, horribly transparent, with the veins at her hands and the sides of her temples a visible cluster of mauve branches and stems. Her eyes fluttered open. They were huge and blue, with velvety brown lashes. The girl coughed up a clot, which ruined the tableau, and those big blue eyes widened in dismay.
"Protesilaus," said the girl. "Stand down."
When the sword didn't move an inch, she coughed again and said unhappily,
"Stand down, you goof. You're going to get us in trouble."
Gideon felt the pressure and the edge remove itself from her neck, and she let out a breath. Not for long, though. It was replaced with a gloved hand pressing over the place where the blade had been, a hand which was pressing down as though its owner would quite like to punch her occipital bone into crumbs. That hand could belong to only one person. Gideon braced to be dropped headfirst into the shitter, and Herohark's voice emerged as though it had been dredged up from the bottom of a charnel house.
"Your cavalier," said the Lady of the Ninth quietly, "drew on my cavalier."
As Gideon died gently of shock, buoyed back to this life only by the weird bruises forming at the top of her spine, the other girl broke out into miserable coughs.
"I'm so sorry," she said. "He's just overprotective. He never would have meant... Oh, my God, you're Black Vestals. Oh, my God, you're the Ninth Cav."
The girl in Gideon's lap covered her face and seemed to break into sobs, but it became apparent that they were gurgles of mirth.
"You've done it now, Pro," she gasped. "They could demand satisfaction, and you'd end up a mausoleum centerpiece. Lady or Lord of the Ninth, please accept my heartfelt apologies. He was hasty, and I was a fool."
"Come on," said Gideon. "You fainted."
"I do that," she admitted, and gave another wicked chuckle of delight. This appeared to be the greatest thing that had ever happened to her.
She fluttered her hands like she was having the vapors.
"Oh, God, I was rescued by a shadow cultist. I'm so sorry. Thank you. This is one for the history books."
Now that the threat of violence had passed, the priest, with difficulty, had dropped to his knees. He unwound the exquisite prismatic scarf at his waist and hesitated before her. The girl gave an imperious little nod, and he began wiping the blood away from her mouth, reverential, seeming far less worried about the entire mess than... Gideon didn't know. Discouraged? Disconcerted?
"Ah, Duchess Septimus," he said in a tweedling old voice, "and is it so advanced as all that?"
"Yes, indeed."
"Oh, lady," he said sadly, "you should not have come."
She gave a flashing, sudden smile, the edges of her teeth scarlet.
"But isn't it beautiful that I did?" she said, and looked up at Gideon, and strained past her to look at Hero, and clasped her hands together. "Protesilaus, help me up so that we can apologize. I can't believe I get to look real tomb maidens in the face."
Great rugged arms thrust past Gideon's vision, and the girl in her lap was lifted up by a 6-foot collection of sinews. The man who'd put the sword to her neck was uncomfortably buff. He had upsetting biceps. He didn't look healthy. He looked like a collection of lemons in a sack. He was a dour, bulky person whose skin had something of the girl's strange, translucent tinge. He was waxen-looking in the sunlight, probably with sweat, and he wore the girl half-draped over his shoulder as though she were a baby or a rug. Gideon sized him up. He was dressed richly, but with clothes that looked as though they'd seen practical wear. A long cape of washed-out green and a belted kilt and boots. There was a shining length of etched chain rolled up and over his arm, and a big swept-hilt rapier hung at his hip. He was staring at Gideon emptily. "You're gigantic," she thought, "but you move awkwardly, and I bet I could take you." The hand at the back of her neck relaxed a fraction. Gideon didn't even get a hard flick to the skull, which boded ill. Whatever punishment Hera was going to mete out would be meted out later, in private and viciously. She'd screwed up, but couldn't quite regret it. As Gideon brushed herself off and picked herself up to stand, the Lady of the Seventh House was smiling. Her babyish face made it difficult to give her a timestamp. She might have been 17 or 37.
"What must I do to gain forgiveness?" she said. "If my house blasphemes against the House of the Ninth in the first 5 minutes, I'm going to feel like a boor."
"Keep your sword off my cavalier," said Hera, in tones of the sepulchre.
"You heard her, Pro," said the girl. "You can't just get your rapier out willy-nilly."
Protesilaus did not deign to reply, his gaze fixed on Gideon. In the awkward silence that resulted, the girl added,
"But now I can thank you for your aid. I'm Lady Dulcinea Septimus, Duchess of Castlereagh, and this is my Cavalier Primary, Protesilaus the Seventh. The Seventh House thanks you for your gracious assistance."
Despite this pretty, even coaxing introduction, Gideon's lady merely bowed her hooded head, her bound eyes giving away nothing. It was with glacial disregard that she said,
"The Ninth House wishes health to the Lady Septimus, and prudence to Protesilaus the Seventh," turned on her heel, and left in an abrupt swish of black cloth.
Gideon was obliged to turn heel and move after her. She wasn't such a fool as to stay. But before she left, she caught the Lady Dulcinea's eye. Rather than being missish or horrified, she looked as though giving offence to the House of the Ninth might prove the highlight of her life. Gideon swore that she was even favoured with a coy wink. They left the priest of the first house there to worry, brow furrowed, folding his scarf, now encrusted with blood. They'd caused a general ruckus. The curious eyes of the other adepts and their cavaliers rested upon the black-robed ninth. Gideon was discomforted to find the gaze of the bloodless third twin on her and Harrowhark both, her pale eyes like sniper sights, her mouth exquisitely chill. There was something in her stare that Gideon disliked on impact, and she held that gaze until the pale head was dropped. As for Teacher's expression, well, that one was hard to fathom. In the end, it was something like melancholy and something like resignation, and he did not say a word about what Gideon had done.
"A blood flaw runs through the ruling house of the Seventh," was all he said, "sparing most who carry the gene, but fatal to a few."
Harrowhark asked,
"Teacher, was the Lady Septimus so diagnosed?"
"Dulcinea Septimus was not meant to live to 25, said the little priest. "Come along, come along. We are all here now, and we've had ample excitement. What a day, what a day! We will have something to talk about, won't we?"
25, thought Gideon, distantly ignoring the ugly twist beneath Harrow's veil that promised that there would be much to talk about later, and that it would not go well for Gideon. 25 years, and Harrowhark was probably going to live forever. They billowed obediently into the priest's wake, and Gideon remembered the coy wink and felt terribly sad.
Chapter 8 They were bidden to sit in a vast atrium, a cavern of a room, a ninth house mausoleum of a room, except that through the glorious wreck of the smeared and vaulted ceiling, light streamed down in such quantities it made Gideon halfway blind again. There were deep couches and seating benches, with cracked covers and the stuffing coming out, with broken arm guards and backs. Embroidered throws that clung to the seats like the skins of mummies, piebald where the light had touched them and dank where it hadn't. Everything in that room was beautiful, and all had gone to seed. It wasn't like back in the Ninth, where unbeautiful things were now old and ruined to boot. The Ninth must have always been a corpse, and corpses putrefied. The house of the First had been abandoned and breathlessly waited to be used by someone other than time. The floors were of wood, where they weren't of gold-shot marble or a rainbow mosaic of tiles gone leprous with age and despair, and enormous twin staircases jutted up to the floor above, spread with narrow, moth-eaten rugs. Vines peeked through in number where the glass of the ceiling had cracked, spreading tendrils that had since gone grey and dry. The pillars that reached up to support the shining glass were carpeted thickly with moss, still alive, still radiant, all orange and green and brown. It obscured old portraits on the walls in spatters of black and tan. It hung atop an old dry fountain made of marble and glass, 3 tiers deep, a little bit of standing water still skulking in the bottom bowl. Herohark refused to sit. Gideon stood next to her, feeling the hot, wet air glue the black folds of her robe to her skin. The Cavalier of the Seventh, Protesilaus, didn't sit either, she noticed, not until his mistress patted the chair next to her own, and then he folded down with unhesitating obedience. The white-garbed skeletons circulated trays filled with cups of astringent tea, steaming green, funny little cups with no handles, hot and smooth to the touch, like stone, but smoother and thinner. The Seventh Cavalier held his, but did not drink it. His adept tried to drink, but had a minor coughing fit that lasted until she gestured for her cavalier to thump her on the back. As the other necromancers and cavaliers drank with varied enjoyment, Herohark held her cup as though it were a live slug. Gideon, who had never drunk a drink hot in all her days, knocked back half in one gulp. It burned all the way down her throat, more smell than flavour, and left a grassy tang on her cauterized taste buds. Some of her lip paint stayed on the rim. She choked discreetly. The reverend daughter gave her a look that withered the bowels. All three priests sat at the lip of the fountain, holding their teacups unsipped in their hands. Unless they were hiding a bunch more in some cupboard, it seemed terrifically lonely to Gideon. The second was the tottery priest, his frail shoulders bowing as he fretted with his blood-stained belt. The third was mild of face and sported a long salt-and-pepper plait. They might have been a woman, and might have been a man, and might have been neither. All three wore the same clothes, which gave them the look of white birds on rainbow leashes. But somehow, Teacher was the only one of the three who seemed real. He was eager, interested, vital, alive. The penitent calm of his fellows made them seem more like the robed skeletons arrayed at the sides of the room, silent and immovable, with a red speck of light dancing in each socket. Once everyone was awkwardly perched on the exquisite racks of furniture, finishing their tea, clutching their cups with the gaucherie of people who didn't know where to put them, making zero conversation, Salt and Pepper Plat raised their pale voice and said, "Now let us pray for the Lord of that which was destroyed, remembering the abundance of his pity, his power, and his love." Gideon and Herohark were silent during the ensuing chant. "Let the King Undying, Ransomer of Death, Scourge of Death, Vindicator of Death, look upon the Nine Houses and hear their thanks. Let the whole of everywhere entrust themselves to him. Let those across the river pledge beyond the tomb to the Adept Divine, the first among necromancers. Thanks be to the ninefold resurrection. Thanks be to the Lictor divinely ordained. He is Emperor, and he became God. He is God, and he became Emperor." Gideon had never heard this one. There was only one prayer on the ninth. All other services were call-and-speaks or knucklebone arisen. Most of the crowd rattled it off as though they'd been saying it from the cradle. But not all. The hulking mass of man-meat, Protesilaus, stared straight ahead without even mouthing the words, his lips as still as the pale third twins. The others joined in without hesitation, though with varying fervour. Once the last word had sunk into silence, Teacher said, "And perhaps the devout of the locked tomb will favour us with their intercession." Everyone's heads twisted their way. Gideon froze. It was the reverend daughter who maintained complete equanimity as she dropped her cup into Gideon's hands and, before a sea of faces,
some curious, some bored, and one, Dulcinea's, enthusiastic, Hera began,
"I pray the tomb is shut forever. I pray the rock is never rolled away."
Gideon had known on some basic level that the religion practiced in the dark depths of Dreaba was not quite the religion practiced by the other houses. It was still a shock to the system to have it confirmed. By the expressions on some of the faces, bewildered or blank or long-suffering, or, in at least one case, openly hostile, the others hadn't been confronted with it either. By the time Hero had finished, the three priests looked softly delighted.
"Just as it always was," sighed the little bent priest in ecstasy, despite the wretched dirge. "Continuity is a marvellous thing," said Salt and Pepper Platt, proving themselves insanely tedious. Teacher said,
"Now I'll welcome you to Canaan House. Will someone bring me the box?"
The gangling silence focused on a robed skeleton who carried over a small chest made entirely of wood. It was no wider than a book, and no deeper than two books stacked on top of each other, estimated Gideon, who thought of all books as being basically the same size. Teacher threw it open with aplomb and announced,
"Marta the Second!"
An intensely dark girl snapped to attention. Her salute was as crisp as her flawless cohort uniform, and when Teacher beckoned, she marched forward with a gait as starched as her officer's scarlets and snowy white necktie. As though bestowing a jewel upon her, he gave her a dull iron ring from the box, about as big around as the circle made by a thumb and forefinger. To her credit, she did not gawk or hesitate. She simply took it, saluted, and sat back down. Teacher called out,
"Naberius the Third!"
And thus followed a rather tiresome parade of rapier-swinging cavaliers in varying attitudes coming up to receive their mysterious iron circles. Some of them took the second's cue in saluting. Others, including the man-hulk Protesilaus, bothered not at all. Gideon's tension grew with each name. When at last in this roll call, Teacher said,
"Gideon the Ninth,"
she ended up disappointed by the banality of the thing. It was not a perfect iron loop, as she had thought, but a twist that overlapped itself. It locked shut by means of a hole bored into one end and a 90-degree bend at the other, so that you could prise it open simply by fiddling the bend back through the hole. The metal in her hand felt granular, heavy. When she returned to her place, she knew Hero was sweating to snatch it off her, but she clutched it childishly tight. Nobody asked what it was, which Gideon thought was fairly frigging dumb. She was near to asking herself when Teacher said,
"Now the tenets of the first house and the grief of the king undying."
Everyone got very focused again.
"I will not tell you what you already know," said the little priest. "I seek only to add context. The lictors were not born immortal. They were given eternal life, which is not at all the same thing. 16 of them came here a myriad ago. 8 adepts and the 8 who would later be known as the first cavaliers. And it was here that they ascended. Those 8 necromancers were first after the Lord of Resurrection. They have spread his assumption across the blackness of space to those places where others could never reach. Each of them alone is more powerful than 9 cohorts acting as one. But even the divine lictors can pass away, despite their power and despite their swords. And they have done so slowly over these 10,000 years. The Emperor's grief has waxed with time. It is only now, in the twilight of the original 8, that he has listened to his last lictors who beg for reinforcement."
He took his cup of tea and swirled the liquid with a twitch of his wrist.
"You have been nominated to attempt the terrible challenge of replacing them," he said, "and it is not at all a sure thing. If you ascend to Lictor, or if you try and fail, the kindly Lord knows what is being asked of you is titanic. You are the honored heirs and guardians of the Eight Houses. Great duties await you. If you do not find yourself a galaxy, it is not so bad to find yourself a star, nor to have the Emperor know that the both of you attempted this great ordeal. Or the all of you," added the little priest brightly, nodding at the twins and their sullen-ass cavalier with a flash of amusement, "as the case may be. Cavaliers, if your adept is found wanting, you have failed. If you are found wanting, your adept has failed. And if one or both is wanting, then we will not ask you to wreck your lives against this impossible task. You will not be forced, if you cannot continue onward, through single or mutual failure, or make the decision not to go on."
He looked searchingly over the assembled faces, somewhat vague, as though seeing them for the first time. Gideon could hear Harrowhark chewing the inside of her cheek, fingers tightly knuckled over her prayer bones. Teacher said,
"This is not a pilgrimage where your safety is assured. You will undergo trials, possibly dangerous ones. You will work hard. You will suffer. I must speak candidly. You may even die. But I see no reason not to hope that I may behold 8 new lictors by the end of this, joined together with their cavaliers, heir to a joy and power that has sung through 10,000 years.
This sank into the room like water into sand. Even Gideon got a minute chill down the back of her neck. He said,
"To practical matters. Your every need will be met here. You will be given your own rooms and will be waited on by the servants. There is space in abundance. Any chambers not given to others may be used as you will for your studies and your sitting rooms, and you have the run of all open spaces and the use of all books. We live as penitents do. Simple food, no letters, no visits. You shall never use a communication network. It is not allowed in this place. Now that you are here, you must understand that you are here until we send you home, or until you succeed. We hope you will be too busy to be lonely or bored. As for your instruction here, this is what the First House asks of you."
The room drew breath together, or at least all the necromancers did, alongside a goodly proportion of their cavaliers. Hera's knuckles whitened. Gideon wished that she could flop into a seat or take a sly nap. Everybody was poised in readiness for the outlined syllabus, and scholarship made her want to die. There would be some litany of how breakfast would take place every morning at this time, and then there'd be study with the priests for an hour, and then skeleton analysis, and history of some blood, and tomb studies, and, like, lunchtime, and finally, double bones with Dr. Skellabone. The most she could hope for was swords, swords 2, and maybe swords 3.
"We ask," began teacher, "that you never open a locked door unless you have permission."
Everyone waited. Nothing happened. They looked at the little priest, and he looked back, completely at his ease, his hands resting on his white-clad thighs, smiling vaguely. A nail went
ping out of a rotting picture frame somewhere in the corner.
"That's it," said Teacher helpfully.
Gideon saw lights dull in every eye that had gleamed for double bones with Dr. Skellabone. Someone ventured a bit timidly, "So, what is the training, then? How to attain Lictorhood?" The little priest looked at them again.
"Well, I don't know," he said.
His words went through them all like lightning. The very air chilled. Anticipation for double bones with Dr. Skellabone not only died, but was buried deep down in some forgotten catacomb. It only took one look at Teacher's kind, open-hearted countenance to confirm that he was not, in fact, screwing with them. They were stupefied with confusion and outrage.
"You're the ones who will ascend to Lictor," he said, "not me. I am certain the way will become clear to you without any input from us. Why, who are we to teach the first after the King Undying?"
Then he added smilingly,
"Welcome to Canaan House."
A skeleton took Gideon and Hero to the wing that had been set aside for the ninth. They were led deep into the fortress of the first, past ruined statuary within the gorgeous wreck of Canaan House, the wraith-like, mansion-like hulk lying sprawled and chipped around them. They passed rooms with vaulted ceilings, full of green light where the sun shone through thick algae on the glass. They passed broken windows and windows wrecked with salt and wind, and open, shadowed arches where reeked rooms too musty to be believed. They said absolutely jack to each other. Except when they were taken down flights of stairs to their rooms, and Gideon looked out the windows now into the featureless lumps of blackness and said thoughtlessly, "The lights are broken." Hero turned to her for the first time since they left the shuttle, eyes glittering like beetles beneath the veil, mouth puckered up like a cat's asshole.
"Griddle," she said, "this planet spins much faster than ours."
At Gideon's continued blank expression,
"It's night, you tool."
They did not speak again. The removal of the light strangely made Gideon feel very tired. She couldn't escape its having been there, even though Driaba's brightest was darker than the darkest shadows of the first. Their wing turned out to be low on the level, right beneath the dock. There were a few lights here outside the huge windows, making big blue shadows out of the iron struts that held up the landing platform above them. Far below, the sea roared invisibly. There was a bed for Hero, an enormous platform with feathery, tattered drapes, and a bed for Gideon, except that it was placed at the foot of Herohark's bed, which she could not have noped at harder. She set herself up with a mass of musty bedding and pillows in front of a huge window in the next room, and left Hero back in the bedroom with a black expression and probably blacker thoughts. Gideon was too tired even to wash her face or undress properly. Exhaustion had spread upward through her toes, spiking up her calves, freezing the bottom of her spine. As she stared out the window into the bluish blackness of night after a day, she heard a huge overhead grinding sound, a big velvety pull of metal on metal, a rhythmic scrape. Gideon watched, paralyzed, as one of the very expensive shuttles fell hugely and silently over the landing platform. It dropped like a suicide and seemed to hang, grey and shining, in the air. Then it fell from sight. To its left, another. Farther left, another. The scraping ceased. Skeletal feet pattered away. Gideon fell asleep.
Act 2. Chapter 9.
Gideon woke to an unfamiliar ceiling, a fuzzy taste on her tongue,
and the exciting smell of mould. The light blazed in red slashes even through her eyelids, and it made her come to all at once. For long moments she just lay back in her nest of old bedding and looked around. The ninth quarters had low ceilings and wide sweeping rooms, decaying away in magnificence before enormous floor-to-ceiling windows. The dock above their quarters cast a long shadow outside, cooling and dimming the light, which gleamed quietly off the chandeliers of festooned black crystals on wire. It would have been muted and peaceful to someone used to it, but to Gideon, on her first morning, it was like looking at a headache. Someone had, a very long time ago, dressed these apartments lavishly in dead jewel colours, dark ruby, dark sapphire, dark emerald. The doors were set above the main level and reached by sloping stone ramps. There was not a great deal of furniture that wasn't sighing apart. The meanest stick of it still outclassed the most exquisite ninth heirlooms back home. Gideon took a particular fancy to the long, low table in the centre of their living room, inset with black glass. The first thing she did was roll away and reach for her sword. Iglamine had spent half of training simply convincing Gideon to reach for her rapier hilt rather than her two-hander, to the point where she'd been sleeping with her fingers on the thing to try to get used to it. There was a note crumpled between her hand and the basket. "Don't talk to anybody." "Guess I won't talk to anybody," said Gideon, but then read on. "I have taken the ring." "Hello?" Gideon bellowed impotently and slapped her hands down into her pockets. The ring was gone. There was no mistake greater or stupider than to let Harrowhark Nona Jessamus at you when you were in any way vulnerable. She should have booby-trapped the threshold. It wasn't like she even cared about the ring. It was just the cut, again and again, of Harrow considering all of Gideon's property her property in common. She tried to cheer herself up with the thought that this at least meant Harrow wasn't around, a thought that would have cheered up anyone. Gideon shrugged off her robe and wrestled out of her trousers and shirt, all of which had hot and damp insides from her sweat. She opened doors until she found the largest bathroom she had ever seen. It was so big she could walk around in it. She stretched out her arms on either side and still couldn't touch the walls, which were of slippery stone, glowing like coals where they were whole and scored and dull where they weren't. Maybe this pretending to be a cavalier gig wasn't so bad after all. The floor was marble tile, sheen marred by only a few spots of black mould. There was a bowl with taps that Gideon knew to be a sink, only because she'd read a lot of comics, and an enormous person-sized recess in the ground that she didn't know what to do with at all. The sonic cleaner was set, gleaming gently, at either side of a rectangular chamber with a weird nozzle. Gideon pulled a lever next to the tap. Water gushed from the nozzle, and she yelped and skittered away before she got over the sight and turned it off. Her survey identified a chubby cake of soap next to the sink, but ninth soap had been made of human fat, so no thanks, and a tub of antibac gel. She decided eventually to take a sonic and to use the gel to scrape the blurred paint off her face. Newly clean, with fresh clothes and her robes shaken out in the sonic, she was feeling good about herself, until she espied another note stuck tersely on the auto door. "Fix your face, idiot!" There was another note atop the paint box, which some skeletal servant had helpfully placed on one of the less precarious sideboards. "Do not try to find me. I am working. Keep your head down and stay out of trouble. I reiterate the order that you do not talk to anybody." Another note was stuck beneath, belatedly. "To clarify,
Anybody is a word that refers to any person alive or dead.
Inside the box, yet another.
Paint your face adequately,
Gideon said aloud.
Your parents must have been so relieved to die.
Back in the bathroom, she smeared cold wads of alabaster on her face. The nun's paint went on in pale greys and blacks, swabbed over the lips and the hollows of her eyes and cheeks. Gideon comforted herself by recoiling at her reflection in the cracked mirror, a grinning death's head with a crop of incongruously red hair and a couple of zits. She pulled her sunglasses out of the pocket of her robe and eased them on, which completed the effect, if the effect you wanted was horrible. Feeling slightly more at ease with life, rapier bobbing at her hip, it was the Cavalier of the Ninth who stalked down the dilapidated corridors of Canaan House. It was pleasantly quiet. She heard the far-off sounds of a lived-in place, footsteps, blurry moans from the auto-cooler, the unmistakable pitter-pat of footbones on tattered rugs, and she retraced her steps to the original atrium. From there, she followed her nose. Her nose led her to a hot, glass-topped hall, modern conveniences haphazardly pasted atop ancient riches, out of place among the tapestries and gone-black filigree. There was netting spread all over the rafters to keep out the birds, because the glass-topped roof had holes in it that you could jump through. A fountain of fresh water burbled at the wall, ringed in old concrete, with a filtration tank snuggled beside. And there were many long-worn tables, wooden slabs that had been freshened up with antibac and had legs that must have come from 8 table sacrifices. The place could have seated 50. The early light flooded down in electric yellow blasts, green where it touched the living plants, and brown where it touched the dead ones, and she was grateful that she'd worn her glasses. The room was nearly empty, but a couple of the others were there, finishing their meals. Gideon sat down 3 tables away, and spied on them shamelessly. There was a man sitting close to a pair of ghastly teens, younger than Gideon, still in the midst of losing their fight with puberty. The boy wore trim navy robes, and the girl had a jeweled scabbard on her back, and when Gideon entered, they had looked up at the cultist of the Ninth with unabashed interest, close to awe. The man close to this horrible pair had a kind, jovial face and curly hair, with clothes of excellent cut and a gorgeously wrought rapier at his side. Gideon reckoned him well into his 30s. He had the guts to raise his hand to her in a tentative greeting. Before she could do anything in return, a skeleton placed a steaming bowl of sour green soup and a massive hunk of lardy yeast bread on the table, and she got busy eating. These were sophisticated skeletons. Hers returned with a cup of hot tea on a tray and waited until she took it to retreat. Gideon had noticed that their fine motor control would have been the envy of any necromancer, that they moved with perfect concert and awareness. She was in a position of some expertise here. You couldn't spend any time in the Ninth House without coming away with an unwholesome knowledge of skeletons. She could have easily filled in for Dr. Skellabone without practicing a single theorem. The sheer amount of complex programming each skeleton followed would have taken all of the oldest and most gnarled necromancers of the locked tomb months and months to put together. Gideon would have been impressed, but she was too hungry. The awful teens were muttering to each other, giving Gideon looks, giving each other looks, then muttering again. The wholesome older man leaned over and gave them some bracing rebuke. They subsided reluctantly, only casting the occasional dark glance her way over their soup and bread, not knowing that she was physically immune. Back in the Ninth, she had endured each meal under Crux's fantastically dismal stare,
which had turned gruel into ash in her mouth. A waiting, white-robed bone servant relieved her of her bowl and her plate almost sooner than she was done. She was quietly sucking tea through her teeth, trying not to drink half a pint of face paint with it, when a hand was stuck out in front of her. It was the hand of the kind-faced older man. Up close, he had a strong jaw, the expression of the terminally jolly, and nice eyes. Gideon was genuinely surprised to find that she was shy, and more still to find she was relieved by Hero's diktat against talking. Gideon Nav, absolutely goddamn starved of any contact with people who didn't have dark missiles and advanced osteoporosis, should have yearned to talk, but she found that she couldn't imagine a single thing to say.
"Magnus the Fifth," he said. "Sir Magnus Quinn, Cavalier Primary, and Seneschal of Coniortus Court."
From three tables over, the loathsome teens greeted his audacity with low moans. They lost all appearance of restrained respectability and instead chorused his name in slow, hurt animal noises, lowing, "Magnus! Magnus!" which he ignored. Gideon had hesitated too long in taking his hand, and with the very soul of manners, he mistook her reluctance for refusal and rapped his knuckles on the table instead.
"Do forgive us," he said. "We're a bit short on black priests in the fourth and the fifth, and my valiant fourth companions are, a bit overcome."
"No, Magnus, don't say we're overcome,"
moaned the nasty girl, sotto voce.
"Don't mention us, Magnus," moaned the other.
Gideon clattered her chair back to stand. Magnus Quinn, Magnus of the Fifth, was too old and too well-schooled to do anything so stupid as flinch. But some reputation of the Ninth House that Gideon had only barely begun to comprehend widened his eyes just a bit. His clothes were so restrained and so beautifully made. He looked trim and tasteful without being intimidating. She hated herself for hearing Hera's voice low and urgent in her hindbrain. "We are not becoming an appendix of the third or fifth houses." She nodded to him somewhat awkwardly, and he was so relieved that he pumped his chin up and down twice in response before he caught himself.
"Health to the ninth," he said firmly, and then jerked his head in what was so transparently a "come on, clear off" motion that even the bad teens couldn't ignore it.
They pushed their bowls away to two waiting, hunched skeletons and tiptoed out in the older man's wake, leaving Gideon amused and alone. She stood there until their voices died away.
"Really, chaps," she caught Magnus saying repressively, "anyone would think you'd both been raised in a barn,"
before she twitched her sunglasses up her nose and left, sticking her hands in the pockets of her robes and heading out in the opposite direction from where Magnus and the crap fourth house youths had gone, down a short flight of stairs. Gideon had nowhere to go and nothing to be, and no orders and no goals. Her black robe flapping at her ankles and the light getting stronger all the time, she decided to wander. Canaan House was a nest of rooms and corridors, of sudden courtyards and staircases that dripped down into lightless gloom and terminated in big rusting doors beneath overhangs, ones that looked as though they would go clang no matter how quietly you tried to shut them. More than once Gideon turned a corner and found she was back at some landing she thought she had travelled miles and miles away from. Once she paused on a blasted terrace outside, gazing at the rusting, hulking pillars that stuck up in a ring around the tower. The sea on one side was broken up with flat concrete landings like stepping stones, set wet and geometric in the water, mummified in seaweed. The sea had covered up more structures long, long ago, and they looked like square heads with long, sticky hair peering up suspiciously through the waves.
Being outside made her feel dizzy, so she headed back inside. There were doors, a multiplicity of doors, a veritable warehouse of doors, cupboard doors, metal auto doors, barred doors to dimly lit passageways beyond, doors half her height with no handles, doors half-rotted so you could voyeuristically look through their nakedness to the rooms they didn't hide. All these doors must have been beautiful, even the ones that led only to broom cupboards. Whoever had lived in the first house had lived in beauty once. The ceilings were still high and gracious, the plaster mouldings still graceful ornaments, but the whole thing creaked, and at one point Gideon's boot went clean through a particularly soft bit of floorboard to empty space below. It was a death trap. She went down a short flight of cramped metal stairs. The house often seemed to split its level without letting her travel very far, but this was farther down and darker than any steps had taken her before. They led to a tiled vestibule where the lights fizzed disconsolately and refused to come on all the way. She pushed open two enormous groaning doors, which led into an echoing chamber that made her nostrils flare. It smelled badly of chemicals, and most of the smell came from the huge, filthy, perfectly rectangular pit that dominated the centre of the room. The pit was lined with dull tile, and it gave the filthiest and oldest parts of the ninth house a run for their money. There were metal ladders going down into the pit. But why would you, though? Gideon abandoned the pit and peered through a set of grubby glass double doors. From the other side of the room beyond, a hunched, cloaked figure peered back at her, and she reflexively went for her rapier. The hunched figure, swiftly, identically, went for its own. "Good going, dickhead," thought Gideon, straightening up. "It's a mirror." It was a mirror, an enormous one that covered the far wall. She pressed her face closer to the glass door. The room beyond had a flagstone floor, stones worn smooth from years and years of feet. There was a rusting basin and tap where one love-abandoned towel had sat for God only knew.